Call this meeting of the Judiciary Committee to order. Members, take your seats. A quorum is present. Members, we have two bills on the calendar. We had three, but Representative Claflin is sick. Don't know if it's coronavirus or not, but she's not coming in to do her bill, which is the responsible thing to do. Which is also why we need paid sick days in Minnesota. Editorial comment. But we still have House File 3103, Representative Moran, Human Rights Act, race definition added, and House File 3127, Human Services modifying requirements for court-appointed counsel and child protection cases. Representative Moran is here. But first, we have the minutes for March 3rd. Has anyone reviewed the minutes of March 3rd and wants to review?
I would move approval.
Chair Considine moves approval of the March 3rd minutes. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Minutes of March 3rd are approved. First bill on the calendar is House File 3103. I move that House File 3103 be recommended to be placed on the general register. Representative Moran, it does not look to me like we have any amendments. So go ahead.
Well, good morning, Chair Lesh and members. I hope we're all doing good. All right. So I am happy to be here this morning to present House File 3103, the Crown Act. So basically, the Crown Act will ban discrimination based on natural hairstyle. So a little background on this bill. So Crown, meaning creating a respectful and open world for natural hair, was launched as an effort to change societal biases and discrimination against African-American women and men's natural texture and hairstyles. According to the Crown research study completed in 2019 by the Joy Collective, African-American women are 80% more likely to change their natural hair to meet Eurocentric standards of appearance, social norms, or expectations at work. African-American women are 50% more likely to be sent home or know of an African-American woman sent home from the workplace because of her hair. African-American women are 30% more likely to receive a formal grooming policy in the workplace. The Crown Coalition was founded by, we all know about Dove Soap, the National Urban League and the local Urban League here, Color of Change, and the Western Center on Law and Poverty, and is supported by over 50 other NGOs and nonprofits. So a little legislative history on the Crown Act was that in July of 2019, the Crown Act was signed into law in both California and New York. New Jersey became the third state to make the Crown Act law in December of 2019. And it has also been introduced in Congress in both the House and in the Senate as of December of 2019. Locally, the Urban League Twin Cities and the Council of Minnesota African Heritage and the City of St. Paul African American History Month Committee are all supportive of this bill, as so is the National Urban League, who is a co-founder of the coalition. This is a priority bill for the Twin Cities chapter. So what you have in language is that since I found out that in the state of Minnesota, we do not have a definition of race. And so as part of the Minnesota Human Rights Act, we have inserted the language that race is inclusive of hairstyles and textures, including braids, locks, and twists. And that's my presentation this morning. I do have several testifiers who would like to speak on behalf of the bill.
Thank you, Representative Moran. Please have them come up.
Okay.
Oh, Commissioner Lucero is here. Mm-hmm. We have a commissioner. Welcome back to the committee, Commissioner Lucero. And please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead.
Good morning, everyone. Hi, my name is Rebecca Lucero, and I'm the commissioner for the Department of Human Rights. And someone much taller than me sat here before me. So Okay, great. It's great to be before you today, specifically talking about this. So our department strongly supports the Crown Act because Black Minnesotans have the right to style their hair in natural styles without fear of discrimination. While race discrimination is already prohibited under the Minnesota Human Rights Act, this bill provides plain language clarity to ensure that the definition of race includes hairstyles inherent to racial identity. As Minnesota's Civil Rights Enforcement Agency, we're dedicated to undoing racial disparities, ensuring every Minnesota can live lives with dignity and joy, and eliminating discrimination. Now, of course, by now, we've all heard the story of DeAndre Arnold, the 18-year-old kid from Texas, who is excited to graduate high school this May. But a recent change in the school's dress code policy required DeAndre to cut his dreadlocks to, his locks to walk at graduation. Now, this is not at all a unique story. Since long before the beginning of this country's existence, black hair has always been something that is both unofficially and officially regulated, and black women in particular are unfairly impacted, as Representative Moran clarified here. Now, a few years ago here in Minnesota, an employer changed their work policy banning employees from wearing their hair in locks or braids and knots. Showing up to work that day, all black employees were told of the policy change. They were told that their natural hairstyles of locks, braids, and knots were no longer in alignment with the new policy. They were told that they needed to cut their hair or be fired. Several were fired. They were fired for insisting on maintaining their dignity by refusing to cut their hair. In this situation, our department was able to intervene and reach a settlement with the employer so that all of those employees were rehired. And the employer had to end their racially discriminatory practices and ensure that didn't happen again with this employer. But we know this continues to happen every day. This discrimination against natural black hair violates an individual's dignity and humanity. It also violates our values as Minnesotans. We can choose to do differently, and that's what we're here talking about today, choosing to do differently. And I want to thank Representative Moran and the Council for Minnesotans of African Heritage for their leadership on this important issue. Thank you, Chair and members of this committee, for your time, and I stand for questions.
Excellent. Thank you, Commissioner. Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have a question for the Commissioner, because I find this, I never heard of this before, people being discriminated on this basis. And so my question is, maybe multiple questions, but other than the case you just cited, are you seeing other cases similar to this over the last, you know, decade, let's say?
Commissioner Lucero.
Sure. Chair Representative Scott, thank you for that question. This has actually been a persistent form of discrimination since the beginning of this country's founding, and we regularly receive calls about this in our office, and there's actually examples of this across the entire country. This particularly affects black Minnesotans and black women in particular, and so that's the demographic that you may run into this most often.
Mr. Chair,
Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question, my next question is, would this prevent a company from having a policy that if you had long hair that where it was a safety concern and whatever the job might be, I don't know, a manufacturing or something like that, would this prevent a company from having a policy that all people have, you know, if I have long hair? Would I have to have it tied back for safety purposes? Would this prevent a company from having a policy that would address that?
Commissioner Lucero.
Thank you. Representative Scott, this bill has nothing to do with safety protections that are in place. And in fact, the Human Rights Act already makes exemptions for those types of workplace safety standards that apply to all folks. This is really about ensuring that black hairstyles that are natural hairstyles aren't fundamentally the reason why someone is prevented from being able to work.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks. And Commissioner Lucero, some of us will be revealing our ignorance on some of this too, which is, of course, is what committee is about. The basis for the company that you referenced, what were their basis for saying, what was their basis for saying the hair had to be cut or they were going to be fired?
Sure. Thank you, Chair Lesh. And of course, we all come with a lot of places where we are continuing to learn and grow. And so in this situation, to answer your specific question, and I appreciate the ability to have vulnerable, safe space conversations here so that we can make these bold changes that need to be made. To answer your specific question, I think there's often a variety of reasons that employers put forth. I think in this case, and this was several years ago before I was here, so I don't have all of the detail. I can come back to you on that. But we often see from employers is really wanting to make sure that there's professionalism, and that professionalism is defined in a way that doesn't include natural hairstyles, which is exactly what then can lead to discrimination and disparities. And so we really want to make sure that there cannot be, that when we're talking about professionalism, that is all inclusive of natural black hairstyles as well.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks. Chair Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, my first reaction was similar to Representative Scott's. I went, really? And you just, Representative Moran, continue to open my eyes on things that, yeah, I had no idea about. Now the next thought I had was they didn't really read their Bible too closely, because I think God likes hair. He had gave Samson hair, and I'm pretty sure that was pretty curly, as the source of his strength. Thank you, Representative Moran, for bringing this forward.
Thank you.
Thanks. Other questions for Commissioner Lucero? Thank you, Commissioner Lucero, for your testimony. If you would stick around in case there are more questions. Do you have other testifiers, Representative Moran?
Yes, we do. Next would be Steve Belton.
Mr. Belton, come on up. In fact, if all the testifiers could just be ready to be up here and be lined up, we're going to do questions for all at the end. So if you could just introduce yourself first, Mr. Belton, and go ahead and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chairman Les. My name is Stephen Belton. I'm the president and chief executive of Urban League Twin Cities. Thank you for the opportunity to be with you this morning. It probably is surprising to a lot of people that in 2020 we are amending the State Human Rights Act to prohibit an act of discrimination that many people didn't even know existed. But I assure you that it does. I speak to this both from abroad, sort of the 20,000-foot level of the National Urban League, which along with the Doug Corporation was effective in getting passed in California and New York, and now New Jersey are the three states that have pioneered the Crown Act. This legislation is modeled after the New York law. But also on a more granular level, I can speak from my own family history. I have two sons who both are professional adults working in New York, both who have had to cut their hair. One had to cut long braids, the other made the decision to cut his locks after having grown them since high school when they entered to the professional workforce in the city of New York. You all have probably heard of the talk that African American parents have with their young men in particular about having police encounters. And so we are also having to have the talk about whether or not they want to make the choice. Because it is an economic choice for them about whether or not they keep their natural hairstyles when they are entering into the workforce. I would point out to you that I am hardly the poster child, for obvious reasons, for the Crown Act. Go ahead and laugh. Everybody else does. But this is a bill that has great resonance, deep resonance, with the African-American community and with African descendants, I should say, more broadly than simply African-Americans. All African diaspora people have expressions of their natural hairstyle, which are as profound and as professional as every other hair group, and they ought to be honored and not discriminated against. I would urge you, if you're not familiar with this, to take a look on Google. Just look up natural hairstyles. You'll see the story of the 6-year-old girl in Florida who was denied admission into her elementary school because of her beautiful, luscious braids. You'll see stories about the young man in Texas or the young person who was the wrestler whose dreads were cut on the floor of his wrestling tournament as a condition of him competing in that tournament. It's just awful. But you're also thinking that this is there. This is not here. The people who will come behind me to testify will share with you stories about being locked out of promotions, locked out of school opportunities, and having to go through a mental calculus that they do every day about whether do I show up or not with my own hairstyle. This is counter to the values of Minnesota, but it's also counterproductive to our workforce. We are in an era now, a time when our workforce is shrinking, when we are looking actively to engage abroad in diverse workforce, and this is a stumbling block for that workforce. And so I'll let some of the people who come behind me share with you the specific details, but I just wanted you to know that we fully support this. We hope that you will support it as well. It's long overdue in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Belton.
And this testifier will be Jasmine Carey.
And each testifier, if you could, we're not going to do questions right after your testimony, but if you could go ahead and stick around because members may have questions for you thereafter. Thank you, Ms. Carey. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Hi, my name is Jasmine Carey, and I am the Legislative and Policy Director for the Council for Minnesotans of African Heritage. I'm before you today just because with our council, our job is to advise the governor as well as state legislatures on issues that impact people of African heritage. And this is one. When we're talking about economic disparities and people trying to get employment and have a sustaining life, a barrier should not be their hairstyle. With this policy that we have here, it's a succinct way to make sure that we're able to address the solution head on, and that's what this Crown Act is. I stand before you with natural hair. I work in state government. It took a long time to get here. I went natural in 2014 when I was working for the city of Minneapolis. It took me seeing someone like Velma Corbo, who is the civil rights director, wear her dreads to know that it's okay to do that. Because as Mr. Belton pointed out, when we have the talk, it's not just a talk about the police, it's a talk about our appearance, how that can kind of be used against us when we're looking for employment. We've had many testifiers at our last hearing who are, some of them aren't able to come, including the employment coach who works with women on the daily, black women, to discuss going to get a job, discuss the hurdles that they face in that, as well as students, as well as family members. I have a friend who worked for a huge corporation here in Minnesota, and she was told that her hair was not presentable, even though it was her own natural hair. So using that as where she left the company eventually because it was just a couple of things on top of another. And if you're not able to be your natural self at a job and feel comfortable, how are you able to grow? So I stand before you as saying that hair texture and hairstyle should not serve as a predictor of one's academic or professional performance or any qualifier for that matter. And our solutions need to be intentional and equitable. And the Crown Act is one of those solutions. And it's a step in the right direction for our country. If we're able to address this out the way, then what can we do next? I think this is an easy thing to do. And I urge you all to vote yes for House File 3103. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Carey. Next testifier.
Next testifier be Iola. I'm going to let Iola pronounce her last name.
Oh, bring the
kid. Ms. Kostreski? Did I get it?
Hi, I am Iola Kostreski.
Kostreski.
Yes.
Welcome to the committee.
And I wrote something. I'm a butter writer. Saturday mornings, the smell of grease, the hands of my mother, the gossiping that occurred, hot combs, the wine of my tender-headed sister. Saturday mornings turned into all day, which turned into my mother yelling, "Don't you dare go play," after I spent all day on your hair. Don't dare be a heathen. I was that heathen anyway. My hair, as my mother would say, my crown of glory, has since I can remember been the topic of conversation. Amongst friends, amongst non-friends, amongst the water cooler gossip that I was never invited to. My hair was politicized the moment I was birthed into this world as a black being, hence why I sit here in front of you now. Sophomore year here in the Twin Cities, I had the best box braids. I was proud. Literally, as Willow Smith said, I whipped my hair around. That proud feeling quickly shattered like a mirror hitting the floor. A student said, "Oh, so we're going to act like your naps grew overnight." A white teacher laughed. He did not stop it. He laughed. Thank you, Mr. Swanson. Fast forward to my first job, which happened to be under District Senator Mimua. My mother worried. She was afraid my afro would not fit in. Iola, when they see you, they will dismiss you. Now, to be clear, District Senator Mimua's office was amazing. It was the ones outside of her walls who weren't so kind. "You should try something a tad more professional," was said by someone who sat in the legislative body. 18-year-old me sat silent. My hair has continued to be that problem. Patients, clients, customers will all be uncomfortable with it. said by countless supervisors and coworkers, this was when I wore my big afro. Or better yet, when I become the petting zoo exhibit. Since my haircut that I've used to express my feelings with various designs that scream black queer magic, I have had people mistaken me for the help or decide whatever meeting I was sitting in, I didn't belong because, quote unquote, I did not look like it. Now, I have never been fired for my hair because my ancestors don't play. Yet, I have understood the in-between message that my hair must be tamed, a message that might as well state you'll be fired if you cannot do this. It's sad that an act like this has to be put into place to protect black hair. Yet, as we have learned from history, laws continuously are needed to humanize black bodies. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Ms. Kostrewski. And I remember when you served in Senator Mua's office, your hair looked fantastic. Any other testifiers you have, Ms. Moran?
That would be the last testifier. My other testifier, Linda Garrett, could not make it this morning.
Understood. Is there anyone from the audience who wishes to be heard on House File 3103? Questions from members? Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Moran, thank you for bringing the bill forward. And I ask this question with absolute respect, mm-hmm. but I just need some clarification. I think there is, if you look at definitions, there is a difference between race and ethnicity, and I'm just wondering why ethnicity was not included in this, particularly when it might encompass, you know, cultural factors, nationality, affiliations, that type of thing. So are we, by virtue of just putting the word race into a definition, are we more narrowly defining that than would be appropriate?
I'm going to call the commissioner to respond to that question.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Moran. Commissioner Lucero.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Albright, thank you. Thank you for that question. And so the way that the bill is written is it is written intentionally to not narrow the definition of race. It's instead written to include and encompass this as part of what it means for race.
Mr. Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So to that point, then my understanding, the definition of race as it is in this bill would then include ethnicity?
Commissioner Lucero.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Albright, this is not meant to be a definition of race. This is meant to demonstrate that when we're talking about race or ethnicity, when we're talking about protected class statuses, period, under the Minnesota Human Rights Act, what we are talking about is this protection as well. And so it's part of it.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm absolutely respectful of this. I'm just, words matter, mm-hmm. and I certainly want to make sure that any legislation that's passed is correct and without interference
Representative Albright, currently in the state of Minnesota, there is no definition for race, right? There is no definition. So, but we kind of like know what race means. Right. So we just wanted to insert that race is inclusive of hair textures and hairstyles, and then define so we can have some clarity around those styles that, like many of you would not know, but historically are worn by African Americans who have been discriminated against, and those hairstyles will include the twists, the locks, and the braids. Because those are the type of cases that we have seen in Minnesota that has been discriminated against.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Do you have the new language for the amendment?
Mr. Chair and Representative Moran, so then the language that you have before the committee this morning would then be inclusive of traditions of particular groups that would want to express themselves pursuant to their customs, traditions, and ethnicity. Would that be correct?
Chair Moran?
I'm sorry, please repeat it again. And maybe speak a little bit louder.
Yeah, I'm sorry. So the definition or the inclusion of race here would include traditions or expressions through braids, locks, and twists as it would pertain to the individual, regardless of their ethnicity. It's more of, so I'm thinking about, not that I would ever do this, Mr. Chair, but if I grew my hair out, would this include me as well? I'm not trying to, you know, denigrate the conversation. I'm just wanting to make sure that the words are correct.
Commissioner Lucero.
So let me try this. I have some for my notes here. So so what we have seen is racial discrimination on the basis of hair in the past, but we wanted to ensure that hair would be included as a characteristic of someone's race. So the protections are there and available for them. But this does not preclude other claims. It does not preclude other claims that may come forth from you. If you decide to, I would love to see that visual in dreadlocks.
I would
look like Thor.
I think you look good.
Does that answer your question, Representative Albright?
Mr. Chair, I appreciate the conversation, and I think Representative Moran probably would be best served by a conversation offline just to have me better understand the issue at hand. Thank you.
Understood. And just by, you know, it's a two-line bill, inclusive of traits associated with race, but not limited to hair texture. I mean, my answer to your question is absolutely. To the extent growing your hair out was associated with your race, then it would absolutely include you. I mean, in my opinion, just by the plain language of the statute, but offline conversation is fine. Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Moran, for bringing this bill. One of the things I'm curious about is unwanted hair touching that I hear that black women face, and I think one of your last testifiers spoke to that issue when she said a petting zoo exhibit. And I was just curious if this bill, if there was somebody who was subject to maybe persistent unwanted hair touching, would be protected under the human rights statute somewhere else from that type of harassment. Maybe Commissioner Lucero could answer that question.
Commissioner Lucero.
Thank you, Chair Representative Mueller. So when we're looking at discrimination, particularly in the workplace or where we're looking at schools, there can be a whole lot of factors that go into deciding whether or not there's discrimination that's protected under, that's prohibited under the law. And so if, for instance, somebody were to complain multiple times that was occurring, and a supervisor refused to address it, or perhaps even you know, retaliate against that employer for complaining about this, then there may be a claim where all of these factors involved may result in discrimination under the law. You're really talking about a situation where, look, things happen all the time, and we just want to make sure that the that employers or landlords or educators understand what the law is, and that they address it, and they address it quickly. And so, of course, we want to create workspaces where people are welcome and included and aren't made to feel that they aren't a petting zoo. And so, you know, part of what a bill like this does is it helps send a clear message that natural hairstyles are welcome and part of our cultural fabric here in Minnesota.
And along with that, can I read you a letter that came from a mother? They could not be here. They testified in the first hearing. So this comes from Danielle Silesi, who said, I wanted to write to say thank you for introducing this legislation. As a mother of a mixed race children, I have seen them struggle with teachers and school officials making inappropriate comments about their hair. Also, my husband had been asked to shave his dreadlocks in order to be hired for a position on several occasions. This year at the Youth in Government, my daughter drafted a fault bill to end the discrimination of natural hair and presented it to her cohort. It was really astounding how many people were surprised that hair discrimination happens, and even many of the kids were against her bill. When I showed her the story that you had introduced the Crown Act here in Minnesota, she started crying because this is so personal to her. She said, we don't live in your district, and they was wondering how they can testify. This was the day before the bill was going to be heard in the last committee. So she said, I was wondering how we can help get this passed. Also, my daughter would love the opportunity to meet you in person and say thank you. And so her daughter showed up, and her daughter testified. She missed school to do this. And so when you look at a Crown Bill Act, yes, we don't want individuals to be discriminated in the workplace. We want the opportunity to be availed, whether you have a straight hairstyle or your natural hair. But I think more importantly, what we also want is we want little girls and boys to know that their hair is beautiful and so are they. That we want teachers to know it's not okay to laugh or not to interject themselves when something inappropriate is happening with little girls and boys in the classroom. And so this is for, you know, all those little girls and boys who have been discriminated against and their self-esteem has been pounded to the ground, right, so that they can stand strong and be okay with who they are. Because this is not about today. This is a historical, a part of the history of African Americans in this country. I read you these stats that African American women are 80% more likely to change their natural hair to meet a Eurocentric standard of appearance and social norm or expectation at work. This is not just one person. This is like, you know, my great-grandmother who decided that how she looked was not good enough. So she pressed her daughter's hair, you know, and it was passed down. And my mother pressed all of our hair. So you talk about the pressing of the hair, that becomes the norm of what we have to internalize as being beautiful and being okay with who we are. And so here we are in the 21st century. And so we want to uplift, because if you are not discriminated against, you don't know discrimination is happening. It happens, and it happens all the time. And so I'm excited about the Crown Bill because it allows us who have been discriminated historically for centuries to say we're beautiful, that we are okay just as we are, and we want to be accepted in the workplace. We want to be accepted in our communities. We want to be accepted in our schools. And it sent a signal to so many of these young people who are crying just because something that someone may see is like, why do we need this? Shows that it is so needed today.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Moran. Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this question's for the commissioner. And just wondering if there's a fiscal note to this, if you think that the addition of this language is going to cause additional work and output for you at the department.
Commissioner Lucero.
Sure. Representative Scott, thank you for that question. There is no fiscal note with this. This is a bill that provides clarity to something that we are already seeing and working on every day. Race discrimination is prohibited under the Minnesota Human Rights Act. We already work those cases every day. We already see, and as the example demonstrated, work cases that result that have to do with discrimination around natural hairstyles. This is making sure that we're providing that clarity in the law that needs to be there.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and a question to the bill author. And I apologize for, I've had multiple conflicts, as you are aware, as a legislator with constituent meetings, so this may have already been asked. Under the bill languages I'm reading here, would it be discriminatory? In my past, I had an employer, believe it or not, when I was younger, I had long hair in the back. And one of my employers required me as a contingent of being employed to cut my hair and have it above the collar. So under this bill language, would that be an act of discriminating against me based on my race?
Commissioner Lucero.
Yep, Chair. Representative Lucero, thank you very much for that question. So I really want to make sure that we're being really clear. This isn't about length of hair. This is about natural hair. And I think that's maybe where there's a little, so this question has been, we've been having this conversation, so I appreciate you asking it again. It's not about the length of hair. Of course, employers can and should have, particularly when it comes to safety standards, some things around that. That is not what we're talking about here at all. We're talking about the dignity that comes with black folks, and black folks being able to not have to press their hair, as Representative Brand's talking about. So it would not apply in the situation you're talking about there.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, reading the language, when I see, you just said natural hair, when I see braids, locks, and twists, that's not natural, right? Braids, locks, and twists are styles. So having the length of a hair is certainly a style. In my plain reading of language, I could put a comma at the end of twists and add length along that list. So I guess I disagree with the interpretation, and as legislators, as we're considering language in front of us, we absolutely have to consider what are the courts going to potentially use as an interpretation. And so I don't read anything in here that would distinguish length as not part of this list that you have in here. And so I have a huge concern for that. Similarly, I used to work at a bakery, and they required hair nets. Mm-hmm. And let's just say somebody had braids, locks, or twists. That wasn't compatible or made it very difficult to do a job, or they themselves interpreted as discriminatory if the employer required them to put their locks in a hairnet. Would that then be discriminatory against their race based on this language?
Chair Lesh and Representative Lucero, you know, women wear long hair all the time. And that, far as I know, has never been a predictor for an employer to say to an employee, to a woman, because you have long hair, we want you to cut your hair. I haven't, if you heard of any of those incidents, let me know, but I have not. Secondly, the bill speaks from a viewpoint of natural hair and hairstyles and hair textures. So, braids, locks, and twists are natural hairstyles. And if you are on a job, you know, as we have gone into restaurants all the time, and if you are a cook or you're in your food, you have to wear a hairnet, you wear a hairnet. This is not about safety. You know, we want safety to be at the, you know, a paramount part of, you know, ensuring that a workplace is safe. Right, and so, yeah, if you have twists or long hair, whatever that may be, or short hair, and you need to wear a hairnet, you wear a hairnet, because that's a part of the job.
One last, just a comment then. So, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Chair Moran. You just said you weren't aware of women with long hair. Well, I don't see anything in this language that limits this to women. Right? This is both men and women. I mean, I don't see any, it's race. It has nothing to do with sex. So a man with long hair, and as you pointed out, the word hairstyles is in here. Mm-hmm. Long hair is a hairstyle. Mm-hmm. And so as somebody who is Hispanic, mm-hmm. why would I not be able to claim you're discriminating against me based on my race because you're making me cut my hair to make it shorter than a collar, than the length of my collar? I mean, it's certainly... I have very strong concerns with this language. I think it opens up, and it's much too vague. So, Mr. Chair, unfortunately, I can't support this language. Thank you.
Representative Hassan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Chair Moran, for bringing this bill. As someone from African heritage, I can appreciate what this bill is trying to do. I grew up watching my cousins and friends, you know, relax their hair, perm their hair, and, you know, work on it every morning for hours and hours so they can fit into the Eurocentric view of beauty standards. And as someone from the mental health field, I can't put enough emphasis on what we're doing, the damage we're doing to children when we tell them that your hair has to be changed to fit into some narrow vision of what a hair should look like, what is an acceptable hair. We're damaging kids, and we're telling them your true self is not good enough, so we have to change some part of you to fit into this vision of what you're supposed to look like. So I appreciate you bringing this bill, and I hope everyone can support this bill.
Reps of her.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Rep. Moran, for bringing this bill forward. I think that, I feel bad that Representative Sarah didn't get to hear Representative Scott's questions around hair and around safety and what it doesn't and it does and doesn't do. And I appreciate the fact that this says race and including these styles, because I think that when you're not from a certain culture in which you're thinking of, if we're thinking of just normal braids, like my girl's braid is different than an African-American child's braids and what that looks like and the connotation around that. And so to specifically say that it is associated with your race, so if you are a Latinx person and part of your racial identity has with your hair, I would say that probably would absolutely be if you were asked to cut it and you had a racial identity associated with that, that absolutely would be included if that's what you're claiming. But this is not, I don't want us to conflate this conversation around just choices. A person's choice to just grow their hair, and I appreciate Representative Albright's question around the choice to grow his hair. The choice, and that's the problem, is we don't realize that somebody knowing that they have a choice to do that, to give a scenario of what if, is such a privilege. Because some people who have hair in a certain way, it is not their choice. And I'm just going to give a really good example, a couple of examples, because how I do not want to make this an African-American issue and a dominant culture issue. This impacts a lot of other races and cultures. In the indigenous community, hair is extremely significant. Young men actually grow their hair long. They cut it for all of these rituals and all of these other specific. This would cover their specific issues. I have issues. I am a curly-haired Asian woman, and my whole life I was told my hair straightened today. I blow it out every single day. When people don't realize that what we're trying, when we have been forced to conform to dominant culture, Western perspectives of what beauty is, of what is considered professional, what is considered right, what is considered acceptable, that those are the types of things that we're addressing in this, that there are cultural significance to why people's hair, ethnic, why their hair may be the way it is. And so I just want us to remember to distinguish between the privilege of choice and the fact that some people do not have choice. And if yours is specifically tied to your culture, then I think this absolutely covers you, whether you are black, you are brown, you are indigenous. And so I just want to make sure that we remember that nuance and that distinction, and that it is not just about that. And remember the privilege that we all have when we get to choose whether we want our hair long or not. There are already provisions in place that protect for safety reasons. If you cannot get your hair into a hairnet to do your job safely, that's probably legal grounds to say you cannot do that job. And so this is to protect outside of those particular areas. And I do just want to say that when you don't have the privilege to choose, it takes me much longer to get ready than somebody else who doesn't have to straighten their hair every day. And my whole life I've been told I should wear my hair a certain way because it's not acceptable for an Asian woman to have curly hair. When my hair is natural, it's actually quite curly all the way to the top of my head. And if I comb it out, it actually is about this big. And so I have been told that I shouldn't show up in the workplace in that way as well. And so I think that this is very broad and this is very needed, and this is not about gender. Men, there are cultural reasons for why young men in certain communities have long hair or have hair in a certain style too. So I just want to make sure, Representative Moran, that I am on, if my assessment of what I think this bill is doing, is it as broad as I'm actually speaking of it? If you could answer that, that'd be great.
Thank you, Chair.
Chair Lesh, and Representative Herr, you're right on. You know, Representative Lucero was not here early when we talked about that, and instead this provision, this inclusion does not preclude other claims that may happen. So it is inclusive, it's, you know, if it's a race, a cultural piece. But I can't explain it. I can't not restate what you just said as clear as you did and as right on as you did. And my hope is that you're learning something here, that you're able to understand a little bit better, and that, you know, often, like myself and others, have to show up in a certain way, you know, to fit in, you know, as an Asian American. Maybe you fit into that, maybe you don't. But there's many of us who have to show up that way and do every single day.
Chair Liebman.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Moran. I was going to say a tiny part of what Representative Herr said, but not nearly as eloquently and and passionately, and I just, that was really wonderful. Thank you so very much. I just love this bill. I love the fact that this is being brought, that we're learning more about this. And I also wanted to just respond to what was said, not nearly as well as that, but I will just add to that that just because we don't do everything in a piece of legislation doesn't mean we shouldn't do anything. So the fact that there may be other situations that might rise to the level of some kind of discrimination or that we might need to do more as time goes on does not mean that we shouldn't move forward with this. I think this is a really important bill, and I am so really moved by this. And thank you so much to the members who've spoken, and especially Representative Moran. This is really important stuff. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. And thank you for bringing this bill, Chair Moran, and thank you for your testimony, Commissioner Lucero. I remember when I worked as a janitor at St. Alphonsus Church School up in Brooklyn Center, and I got hired by two middle-aged white guys, Gary and Terry, blue-collar guys who wore their keys on their belt. They jingled all the time. And they came of age. Both these guys had long hair, very long hair, and they were proud of it. They came of age in the 70s. Long hair for guys and for women was a big deal. And this was in the 90s when I worked at this school. And everything trending in the news, the headlines at that time was about driving while black, people being pulled over for the color of their skin. Now, these two guys, Gary and Terry, that I worked with, were not particularly socially conscious individuals. They were blue-collar, salt-of-the-earth guys. But they remembered when they, in the 70s, and they were teenagers, they had long hair and they were proud of it, they remember being pulled over for their hair. They remember cops targeting them for their hair. And 20 years later, they were still extremely impacted by that, to the extent that they could identify with being profiled in a certain way, even though they couldn't necessarily identify with growing up as anything other than white in Minnesota. And that was important to me. That was an important lesson to learn, even though I didn't have that experience, to see how it impacted people in their lives of being targeted for a certain way based on how they looked, especially their hair. When I got to college, I read the autobiography of Malcolm X, and the multiple passages in there about how he used conk on his hair to straighten it, and it had lye in it, and it burned your scalp, and the longer you left it in, the longer it stung, the straighter you got your hair, and it was that important to him to fit in culturally in that way, which struck me as significant. The way you portrayed it, or I guess the way Alex Haley portrayed it, was something that that I don't forget. And then also, those of us in Minnesota of Scandinavian or Norwegian heritage, not me, I'm Irish and Silesian, but a lot of Scandinavians up here, when they did excavations of folks in Viking settlements, either in Scotland, Ireland, or other places, you know what they found on those excavations? They found combs. Those Vikings were obsessed with their hair. It was long hair, and they combed it a lot. They always found combs. It's a significant identity aspect of who we are, no matter what our culture is. And I think this conversation is important because when we try to draw the bright line as, well, wait a second, you know, what about if an employer says you got to cut it for certain aesthetic reasons? We're making a conscious choice. That's what this conversation in this committee is about. We're making a conscious choice about whether that's okay. And the default position of those of us who grew up in Minnesota is to say, well, of course, yeah, if you got to cut your hair for your job, you got to cut your hair for your job. Well, hold on a second. Maybe that's not okay. Maybe it shouldn't be okay. Maybe if you can't make a real rational basis for that, maybe we shouldn't say employers can just do that willy-nilly. And I think that's what this conversation is about. And I think that's why I wanted to give your bill a hearing, Chair Moran, and why I'm going to be supporting it, because I'm not so sure that should be okay, unless you can really make a solid case beyond the pretexts for what is potentially discrimination, that I don't think maybe employers should be able to do that. So that's why I support it and why I gave it a hearing. Any other members of the audience who wish to be heard on House File 3103 today?
Then the motion is before us that House File 3103 be recommended to be placed on the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All of those opposed say no.
No.
Motion passes. The bill is referred to the General Register. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Lesh.
To all the testifiers. The next bill is Representative Moran's House File 3127. Child welfare modifying requirements for court order appointed counsel in child protection cases. I move that House File 3127 be recommended to refer to Government Operations Committee. And Chair Moran, you have a DE2 amendment. And I will move the DE2 amendment to put the bill in the shape the author so desires. Is there any discussion on the DE2 amendment? All in favor of the DE2 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. The bill is amended. Chair Moran, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Chair Lesh. The parent representation in child protection proceeding in child protection is a really important bill that has brought together many stakeholders over a year or two of discussions around having parents represented in the courtroom when a child has been removed from the home. So what the DE2 delete all does, instead of moving a bill at this current time while we still try to figure out how to collectively come together, it creates a task force. So this bill is about presenting or creating a task force. So what I would like to do is talk to you a little bit about what has taken place thus far in regards to the conversation around legal representation for parents in the child welfare system. So we are asking, when we cannot keep children at home and removal is necessary, children fare better when their parents have consistent and quality attorneys available. High quality legal representation for parents in child protection proceedings leads to better outcomes for children and families, but some Minnesota parents are appearing in court with no representation at all. This is because Minnesota is one of only 8 states that does not mandate or require representation for parents. Preliminary research here in Minnesota suggests that parents in many counties may not have attorneys at their initial hearing. National research on this is clear. High quality legal representation for parents from the initial hearing on leads to better outcomes for children and families. These better outcomes include avoiding foster care, shorter placement in foster care, decreased reentry, pre-petition prevention, and increased reunification. The American Bar Association and the Center on Children and the Law highlights this research in their fact sheets detailing a standard for high-quality legal representation for parents who have their children removed. I think you have a fact sheet including your folder. So following collaboration with multiple stakeholders, the bill has been amended to propose the formation of a legislative task force to make recommendations for implementation, lawyer recruitment, and retention. The division of costs between counties and states relating to the proposed changes to mandating legal representation. Such a task force will provide a meaningful opportunity for stakeholders to come together to discuss logistical questions around the implementation of mandated legal representation for indigent parents. Specifically, the new language proposes that a parent representation in the child protection cases, that the task force be created to make recommendations for expanding the right to court-appointed counsels to all eligible parents, guardians, and custodians in all child protection proceedings where a child is at risk of imminent removal from the child's home or has been removed from the child home. Members and Chair Lesh, I think this is a bill that is hugely needed right now. I don't think in any other cases where, whether it's a court-appointed public defender or others, that someone can show up in court and not have representation. This is paramount, because we're talking about children being removed from their home. We're talking about the lack of parents who are scared, who are frightened, being included in a system that is cumbersome to navigate. Representation is needed. And so I share these points in hope that you can support this bill. Thank you. So next with me, I have
Joanna Woolman.
Woolman, who have done an awesome job of just bringing together stakeholders to talk on this topic.
Thank you, Chair Moran. Go ahead, Ms. Woolman.
Good morning, Chair Lesh. My name is Joanna Woolman. I'm so happy to be here today with Representative Moran in support of this important bill. I'm the director of the Institute to Transform Child Protection and a professor of law at Mitchell Hamlin School of Law, where I've been there about 11 years. Prior to that, I worked as a public defender. And for the last 15 years, I've provided direct representation to parents in child welfare cases in numerous counties in Minnesota. And I also work nationally to advocate for parent representation funding and reform. I'm here today to support this bill and encourage you to pass this bill, to create a task force to move forward with improving Minnesota's parent representation system. And I'd like to provide a little background today, because it is our hope we'll be back next session with a more specific and substantive bill. When the government comes into a home and removes a child, the fundamental right of that parent is at stake. As a parent myself, I cannot imagine the confusion, anger, or fear that I would feel in this traumatic situation. Our laws require that within 72 hours of this child's removal, a court hearing occur to determine whether that removal is constitutional. However, our laws do not mandate the appointment of a lawyer for indigent parents at that hearing or in general. Many parents in Minnesota appear at that hearing without a lawyer. This is the hearing where the courts decide so many critical issues. First, is that removal constitutional? Is it okay for that child to be removed? The court also at that hearing determines whether there are relatives available for placement of that child. The court determines whether there's a possibility that child could go home under safety conditions, and also what visitation is required to be between a parent and a child. It is unacceptable in Minnesota that parents attend that hearing without a lawyer. We are one of only 8 states that does not mandate counsel. Our current statute says that a judge shall appoint an attorney for a parent if they feel it is appropriate. We need to change that standard to mandate appointment in all cases for indigent parents from the first hearing on. Just a minute on the history of parent representation in Minnesota. When I started practicing, I worked for the Public Defender's Office, and prior to 2009 in Minnesota, these cases were handled statewide through the Public Defender's Office. The Public Defender's Office in 2009 asked to be removed from that obligation because it wasn't constitutionally mandated. Their request went up to the Minnesota Supreme Court, and the Minnesota Supreme Court agreed with the Public Defender's Office at that time, and in 2009, representation of parents in child welfare cases dramatically changed from a state-funded, state-trained, statewide system to a county-by-county system. And from 2009 on, attorneys have been appointed and paid for by counties in Minnesota. What this looks like and what this means is that depending on where you live in Minnesota, there is a real difference in your access to and availability of an attorney to represent you as a parent. That is not just, that is not fair, and there should not be a difference in the quality or type or access to representation if you live in a rural county versus a metro area. As Representative Moran pointed out, national research is crystal clear that providing high quality lawyers for parents from the first hearing on is good for kids. In 2009 in Minnesota, a task force was convened. By then, Justice Helen Meyer of the Minnesota Supreme Court, in light of this major shift that had occurred in parent representation. In 2009, that task force recommended to this body that changes be made to our statute to mandate appointment of counsel for all indigent parents in Minnesota. That was 11 years ago. That change has not occurred, and we are so happy to be here today to be able to ask you to take the first step to make that change a reality in Minnesota. However, this change will not be easy. Counties have been bearing the cost, the entire cost, of representing parents, and they have serious and legitimate concerns about how they would pay for this sort of change. Courts and court administrators are worried there won't be lawyers to handle these cases in rural areas if we create a mandate for counsel. These are legitimate and important questions, and this is why we are here today asking for the creation of a task force to be able to look into these important issues. One thing I would also like to mention is that in 2019, for the first time, the federal government, through the Children's Bureau, made Title IV-E funds available for the first time to support parent representation. That is a game changer. What that means is that counties and the state of Minnesota can now request a match in federal funding for monies that they expend to pay for parent representation. It is our hope that this implementation task force will also really address and look at how Minnesota can take advantage of that opportunity. The state of Minnesota has not contributed for 10 years to the cost or bared any of the burden to pay for lawyers for parents who are indigent, and I think that's also an important part of this conversation. At what point can we start to share this cost between counties and the state of Minnesota? Thank you so much for your time this morning, and I would be happy to answer any questions you have.
Thank you, Professor Woolman. I should ask Chair Moran, do you have other testifiers who can come up for us?
Lorraine Wade is here.
Yes.
Let's hold off on questions then until the other testifiers.
Lorraine Wade.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Good morning. My name is Lorraine Randall Wade.
Go ahead, Ms.
Randall Wade. Thank you, Chair and committee members. I have been working with parents whose children are in out-of-home placement over the past 8-9 years now, and I'm here today to share the experiences that we have. When I say we, I mean myself, the parent mentors that work for the organization that I work with called Minnesota One Stop for Communities. We provide direct supports to family, to parents who have child protection cases. And so we're usually there on the first day when parents have to enter and see the judge. And so there are moments where parents don't have attorneys, and they don't understand what's going on. They don't understand the language and the papers that they've been served. They don't understand the accusations or the alleged accusations that are in the petitions that judges read. And by not having an attorney there with them to help them, it prolongs their case. It is detrimental to their case. I often look at it like criminal court. There are attorneys that are provided for individuals in criminal court to be able to prove whether they're innocent or whether they're guilty. In child protection court, it's not the same. Parents don't have the means to prove whether they're innocent or guilty of whatever the accusations that are brought or whatever the report that has come in. And so by not having someone there to help them understand the statutes, the rules, and the laws of what it is they must do, it's not in their best interest. There are a lot of fathers that are served papers to come to court, and they don't get as much attention as the mother who has the child protection case in court. Fathers are also missed when it comes to providing them with legal representation in child protection court. It's hard. As a mentor, trying to provide supports to parents. We're not attorneys, but we understand the legal system, so we can sometimes help them understand that jargon, that language that's used that is really difficult to understand. But we're not attorneys to be able to tell them what they should do, should they admit, should they deny, though we're not attorneys to be able to do that. So in rural counties, and our organization has been as far as Rice County, as far as St. Louis County, and on those ends where parents don't have legal representation either, it takes days, and sometimes it takes 2 to 3 court dates before they can even get an attorney in there to help them. And their time has not stopped. The clock is not, the clock is continuing to tick, because in child protection, once you enter into court, you have almost 365 days to either bring your child home with you, or there's going to be some decision made in that arena where children are either going to go with kin or they're going to go back home with the parents. When parents in rural counties don't have attorneys for 2-3 court dates, that's almost 90 days tops. And so I am here in favor of a task force being appointed, because parents who have children that are fighting for their children in child protection need to be afforded the same abilities as an individual that could possibly afford an attorney. And a lot of families in child protection, they're in there for poverty is one of the reasons why they're in there. And because they can't afford an attorney doesn't mean that their children should live in foster care any longer than what is needed. And so I just wanted to be able to share that today, that it is very important that parents across the state of Minnesota at the onset of the child protection court date should be provided legal representation. Thank you.
Thank everyone. You for your testimony, Ms. Grandel Wade. Are there other testifiers you have?
I believe that's the only other.
Okay. Is there anyone else from the audience who wishes to be heard on House File 3127 as amended? Then we'll move to committee discussion and questions. Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Moran, thanks. I know that your original bill was to make changes to law, and this is a task force, but I think this is a good thing to hash out. And I would encourage you to add at least 2 more parents to the task force, because it's their stories, I think, that are going to be influential in coming to a determination here. And I just want to ask the testifier that came back to the table, Ms.
Grandel Wade.
Woolman. Mm-hmm. Oh. One of the things you mentioned at the onset of your testimony today was that when the government comes into a home to remove children, you spoke about, you know, that there's a fundamental right that might be at stake here. And I'm just wondering if you could elaborate on what you mean by that and what fundamental right those parents have.
Ms. Woolman.
Of course. I actually teach constitutional law, so I would be happy to talk to you about that. So you have a fundamental right under the United States Constitution to parent your children. That right we know is not absolute, as is evidenced by our child protection policies. But in order to determine the constitutionality of that right, you need to have a judge make a legal determination about whether the removal of that child is constitutional. So the right I'm talking about is the right that originated, I don't know, more than 70 years ago, that we have a fundamental right to parent our children. And to intervene with that right, there needs to be a showing that that child is in extreme danger.
Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for elaborating on that. One of the things I, in a related question that I have is, you know, if we're going to have parents have attorneys in these situations, so, you know, in family court, a lot of the litigants or a lot of the parents are pro se, mm-hmm. as it is with this issue too with Child Protective Services. And so should parents in family court and civil court also be given attorneys, court-appointed attorneys, if they are unable to afford one?
Professor Woolman.
I would just like to clarify that
Most custodial parents in Minnesota whose children are removed ultimately get a lawyer. Non-custodial parents, as Ms. Wade mentioned, fathers, often it's much later in the game that they're appointed a lawyer. And many parents in Minnesota in child welfare cases do not have a lawyer at their initial hearing. But I would say that there is not a parent in Minnesota who faces termination of parental rights without an attorney. They are ultimately going to get an attorney. So I don't want your characterization of what's happening to be people never get lawyers. Although this bill does not look at, this doesn't contemplate the idea of civil Gideon, which is what you're talking about, right? So you have a constitutional right to a lawyer in a criminal case in the United States. You do not have a constitutional right to a lawyer in a civil case, and that includes child protection cases. Most states in the country, 42 of them, have decided that these cases are critical enough. When you risk losing your permanent right to parent in a termination, 42 states in the country have decided that right is so significant that they mandate appointment of counsel for indigent parents to make sure that that parent will not face that legal challenge without representation. Minnesota is one of 8 states that has not made that choice. But this bill does not contemplate family court.
Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I realize that this bill does not contemplate family court, but right now in family court, there are people that have their, for all intents and purposes, have their parental rights taken away, and there's no finding of fact hearing to see if there's been abuse or anything like that. Some people have their right to parent their child stripped away in family court, and I dare say in some cases it's easier in family court to get your child ripped away from you than it is in this Child Protective Services, and I've seen it happen. Mm-hmm. I have a dear friend, they adopted their niece under the Child Protective Services court. That took 3 years for that child to be removed from that parent who was clearly not a fit parent. It happens every day in family court. And so the reason for asking my questions the way I did was to draw some parallels, because I think there are some, and I think it's just good food for thought as we think about this issue and families in general. And no one around this table or in this room would advocate for a child ever to be in an unsafe home, but we also don't want to advocate for a child being yanked away from their parents without just cause. And so that's all, that's my only point. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the levity.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Chair Moran, for bringing this bill. And I just had a question about the membership. So on here you have County Court Administration, County Social Service Administrators, but then we have a letter in our packet from Association of Minnesota Counties asking for County Administration to be on the task force. I was just curious if the a response to that letter.
Thank you, Representative. I neglected
Professor
to mention,
Woolman.
Thank you, Chair. In my initial testimony, there have been 2 requests for amendment of this bill. The Minnesota Association of Counties filed this letter, and we absolutely planned, it's a completely friendly amendment. I think we just didn't get it's a semantics issue. We didn't get the wording right. So we would be looking, if this bill passed through this committee, to certainly make that change before the next committee hearing. And I also received information this morning from the judiciary that they would also like to clarify a request that the members appointed by the Minnesota judicial branch would be appointed by the Chief Justice. And we are, of course, open to that amendment as well. So my anticipation would be a couple small tweaks to that membership would occur before the next committee hearing.
Thank you. Chair Considine.
Thank you, Chair Lesh. Ballpark, how many hearings across the state are we talking about that would then require an attorney?
Professor Woolman.
So, great question. Thank you for asking that. There's a real dearth of data around this issue in Minnesota. And about a year and a half ago, we put together a preliminary report
And so I think it's unclear how many rural counties right now are not providing attorneys at that initial hearing and when those attorneys are going to be appointed. In most bigger counties, this statutory change is going to have very little impact, right? Because like in Hennepin and Ramsey, you come to court, you get a lawyer, your first hearing. What we would hope to happen is happening in these metro areas. I don't have a great answer for you today. Some initial research indicated that maybe in 40% of the counties, that may be high, there's no lawyer at the first hearing, but I don't know how accurate that research is. So one of the things that I think has been challenging is figuring out what the scope of this problem is. I can tell you this, that we surveyed individually all 87 counties in Minnesota, and what we learned is that Minnesota spends approximately $4.5 million a year on this, and we got that number by individually calling and asking each county what their parent representation budget for the last year was. We attempted to find out information about where there were lawyers at initial hearings, and that research is not accurate. We made a request to the judicial branch about a month ago to inquire about collecting data through a public data request, and they do not keep track of that information.
Sure, Counselor. I'm trying to wrap my head around the scope of the problem. Not so much a specific number, but are we talking tens of cases, hundreds of cases, thousands? I mean, just like I say, a real ballpark idea of where we're at.
Thank you. I would say hundreds to thousands, hundreds of cases for sure, more than 10. There's about 11,000 kids removed last year in Minnesota. So that can give you a sort of scope of the total number of children removed.
And that's, I'm not trying to nail down a specific number, but as we heard, we passed the thing a couple years ago to make sure every 10-year-old had an attorney, which was actually their right from the beginning. But the feedback I got was how overwhelming it was for certain jurisdictions, public defenders. I'm looking at this, and I'm hoping that one of the places that the task force will look is we'll need to allocate resources to the public defenders, and thousands on top of what they're at right now, which I believe the last thing I heard was they have about average of about 10 minutes with their clients prior to going into court. I would question just how good a representation you can do with 10 minutes. They really need resources, and we need to have a lot more public defenders if we're going to pursue this.
Chair
Johnson.
Thank you.
Okay,
go ahead.
Chair Lash, Representative Moran, thank you for changing this to a task force. It's something that probably should be looked into. A few years ago, we did some changes for child protection. It stemmed from an incident where the child was from my district, and I believe the child was killed in Representative Scott's district. And we made some major changes because the child protection services failed. There was plenty of things that had gone on in both counties, but they hadn't communicated back and forth together. And so the system failed, and we made a number of changes to strengthen the ability for child protection services to protect the children. I'm probably the only one in this room that's actually had to take children away from their parents. It's very difficult to do. I can think of one case that I dealt with where there was 21 layers of blankets in the crib with needles mixed in with all the blankets that were soaked in molding that the child was sleeping on. And then there was two other smaller children in that room as well with drug paraphernalia and needles all over the house. And even then, we knew we had to do it and had to take those kids, and Child Protection Service did their best to work with the parent not to take those kids away before we got to that point. But then 2 weeks later at the hearing when they finally got to go home, seeing the smiles on those kids' faces, because they were actually happy for the first time and doing things that they weren't able to do at home because of the lifestyle of the mother. Then I also think of my cousin's child, Mason. And that one was even more difficult. That actually dealt with, because the mother was Native American, dealt with the Indian issue. And my cousin, the mother of that was the father, and the mother of that child were heavily into drugs. Mason had some serious medical issues, had to have a special diet, needed a transplant, very seriously needed a transplant, finally ended up getting that. But when doing the work, they ended up removing the rights of the mother, and they gave that to my cousin's sister. And Mason now is I think he's in second grade now, and he's just running around like crazy, had his transplant. But, so we need to make sure if we do things to protect the children, also protect the parental rights, and I think the task force might be the way to do it. But I think, I agree, there's some other people that should be involved, but if you get a task force too large, nothing gets done. And I would make a suggestion. I know you'd like to be on the task force because this is your idea. But I think a task force like this, maybe the legislature should stay out of it and let the people involved with it deal with it and bring back a recommendation to us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Woolman, thank you for your testimony. I want to revert back to your comments made about the task force that was convened in 2009 by Justice Meyer. And if you could summarize for me again just the relevant bullet points or the outcome of that task force at that time.
Certainly. And I would also be happy to provide you with a copy of that report. It's a really well done report. It's the last serious report that was done on this issue in Minnesota, and it was really well done. The recommendations that came out of that task force were specifically to make a change to Minnesota Statute 260C.163 Subdivision 3 to require or mandate appointment of a lawyer for all indigent parents in Minnesota from the first hearing on. And the recommendation was, the second recommendation from that task force was to create a statewide system of parent representation outside of the Minnesota public defender system. Those were the two critical recommendations that came out of that task force. And so if you remember at the time, I think that the court at the time was concerned about this shift from the state to the counties. And so their recommendation was to keep it at a statewide implemented representation model. That didn't happen. We moved to the county model. But their number one recommendation was the exact sort of statutory change that we're hoping to make in the next year or two.
Mr. Chair and Ms. Woolman, and I think Representative Moran's intentions are, you know, true to what I would believe as well. So this is not, you know, to spurn the amended of the DE2. But from what you're just saying, the original language in 3127 kind of gets at what that 2009 task force really urged us as a legislative body to adopt. And so, Representative Moran, I'm just curious why we have not chosen to move forward on the original 3127.
So, Chair Lesh and Representative Albright, I'm just going to share what I know a little bit about where we are with the child welfare system. So, for Representative Johnson, he talked about Eric Dean, who died, you know, at the hands of his mother after several reports, I think 10 or 12 reports, which none was substantiated. And finally, she killed him. And the governor created a task force, right? And from that task force, came 90 plus recommendations none that aligned with what we see here. And so out of that task force, it came the abundance of children going into the system. One, because, you know, it was an overhaul of DHS, the commissioner was removed, new commissioner appointed, you know, just a whole overhaul. In my world, I would say, why did we go into that county and find out what was going on with those social workers, that none of those cases was substantiated, but we overhauled the system, because that's how we all often respond. And from that, we had an influx of kids who came into the system. Many of the reasons that kids came to the system were for arbitrary reasons. Some were poverty, some, you know, there are some real, you know, horrendous cases where children need to be removed. But often what we found that child protection workers were afraid that they would be the next person fired, or they would be the next one blamed for Eric Dean. And so just an influx. And what that influx really does, it for kids who really do need to be protected, there's no space for them, because now we don't have enough foster care homes. We don't have enough foster parents, you know. And so we created this process where we was moving in a place of fear. We were moving in a place that we need to do something to make sure there's not another Eric Dean. But we overturned a system that that many found that we're in this crisis mode. But we want to protect kids. But without looking at the trauma and all the other things that have been imposed on children from that removal. Because there's research and data says that every time we remove a child from their home, the trauma that happens for that child is worse as losing a limb often. So we never have gotten back to this place about parent representation. What does it mean to really move us to a system that's in the best interest of children, having parent representation? Because I would say with Representative Scott, you know, and looking at family court, but that initial meeting when a parent shows up without representation, unable to defend themselves, or are scared, unafraid, just don't know, the judge is making a decision. And often that decision has been to remove a child from the home, right? Without, you know, there could have been a safety plan that was created. There could have been so much other things that could have happened, just often does not happen. And so this bill here, and why we moved to a task force, because there has been a lot of key stakeholders who have come together and worked on this for a long time under the leadership of Ms. Wollman. And just last year in 2019, the federal government created this Family First legislation. If you have not heard about it, I would say take some time to look into Family First Prevention Services Act and what that looks like, because there's an opioid epidemic. And because of the opioid epidemic, they are sending even more kids into a system. And so we know that, you know, part of that conformity that we did here in Minnesota in 2019, that there are these Title IV dollars that we can use for parent representation, because the counties are worried about the impact it's going to have on them to do the job and be able to afford and pay for it. But there are some Title IV dollars that we can reach back from the federal government to even help pay for family representation. But of course, counties are still concerned. And so we want to bring together a task force to really get some clarity about how we can make this initiative that we say it needs to be a statewide initiative that really is impacting the rural community more than the urban core, because Hennepin in my county, I hear over 80% of the parents are getting representation from a lawyer at their initial hearing. But it's unfair to have parents to show up and not have someone to serve them in their best interest, or whatever that may look like. That's up to a lawyer and a judge. I can only imagine what I would look like if it was me showing up in front of a judge and not have any representation, and to know what that means and what that looks like, or to presume that I am guilty because I'm in poverty. But there is an opioid epidemic that is definitely impacting families across the state of Minnesota. So that's my piece, Representative Albright. I don't know why we haven't got there, but that's a part of why we've never got to this place where we have to value the child and parent relationship.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Moran, you and I serve in a number of joint capacities, and I think, you know, when we take a look at what our call is as legislators, it's really to three different groups of people, particularly in what you and I serve on Health and Human Services, you know, the those that are in the dawn of life, those that are in the twilight of life, but those that are in the shadows of life, such as what we're talking to in this bill, I think more than the other two categories are forgotten and kind of just neglected. And so while I certainly appreciate the task force to build upon the work that was done by Justice Meyer 10 years ago, it I'm sure it's still relevant and needful, I would urge you, and this is not a question, but I would urge you to reconsider the removal of that language in 3127, where you are actually looking at taking care of those children in an immediate way, by your very words, making sure that parents have proper representation. I recognize that there's an appropriation at the end of the original bill, but I'm sure that, you know, folks certainly would appreciate the emphasis on making sure that those in the shadows of life are well served. That's exactly what this bill goes to. And a task force implemented going on to see how do we adjust and nuance what that first report did and build upon it so that we're refining the nature of what we are called to do for people that are at risk. So I applaud your work.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Albright. There being no one else from the audience here to testify on House File 3127 as amended, the motion is before us that House File 3127 as amended be recommended to be placed on the referred to Government Operations Committee. I want it not to be lost on you, Chair Moran, that I did schedule this bill for a hearing before it was a task force. So I think I concur with Representative Albright in terms of us wishing that there be some policy to come out of this, but I also recognize your willingness to compromise with people and act in good faith to bring the parties together. That's always a good thing around here, but I absolutely would like to see some policy movement on this as well. Folks recall Dakota County having been sued by folks for spanking, taking kids out who were spanked. I think that lawsuit was dismissed, but it still remains a relevant issue in multiple counties. And as a prosecutor for multiple years, I know that folks got attorneys for misdemeanors. That's an expired tab that you forgot to buy in time for your license plate. And when you can't get an attorney when your kid's being taken away, that is far more relevant, I think, to most folks. That's a substantial issue for us in Minnesota. So thanks for doing this. The motion is that House File 3127 be recommended to be re-referred to Government Operations Committee as amended. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. And the bill as amended is re-referred to Government Operations. Members, we've got tomorrow, Representative Elkins, 3075, Representative Stevenson's 1424, and then I have tracking warrant identifiers and safe at home provisions. There being no other business before the committee is adjourned.